when you're ready.
Your Honor, may it please the Court.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your Honor, may it please the Court. The decision below should be remanded and Mr. Bearchild given a new trial.
You're doing just fine. May it please the Court, my name is...
Oh. My good morning threw you off. Sorry.
It did. I didn't want to bore the Court. Your Honor, may it please the Court, my name is Catherine Cherry and I represent Mr. Bearchild in this case. So the decision below should be remanded and Mr. Bearchild given a new trial due to fundamental charging errors in the district, in the jury instructions that were presented by the district court. In addition, Mr. Bearchild's inability to call key witness, Ms. Sarah Simmons, also resulted in his inability to put on his case and have a fair trial. The two jury instructions that are at issue in this case are instructions 10 and instructions 12.
Well, let me ask you about Ms. Simmons being a key witness, because he was representing himself at that time, and you're, and we thank people for doing pro bono work, and you're handling this pro bono on appeal. But you have to put yourself in the position of, you know, if you are a trial judge and you have a pro se litigant, there's certain things you don't make their life harder, but you can't try their cases either in terms of you have to respect their autonomy and recommend and statements that they make. And so you now designate Ms. Simmons as a key witness, but in the district court, Mr. Bearchild referred to Mr. Ball as his main witness, and the court made an accommodation for Mr. Ball to testify. So the trial judge has to respond to what's in front of him or her at that particular time. And also we know of Ms. Simmons that she wasn't, there were prior statements that she had given where she claims that she hadn't seen certain things. So why should we let you now recharacterize his position that she was just a witness, not his key witness or main witness, and then you get to completely, make a different argument here, that if he had said that to the judge might have responded differently?
To break that question into a few, Your Honor, the first question is, was Ms. Simmons as important as I say Ms. Simmons is on appeal? And I think that she was, Your Honor. Mr. Bearchild, in every witness list, in every document from his complaint on, mentioned Ms. Simmons as the person who was there and who observed.
But you have statements of her. What did she? She didn't see much.
We do have statements, but I think it would have been important in this case to have follow-up to those statements. For example, Ms. Simmons said she saw the assault, she saw the pat-down and then she left and Mr. Bearchild seemed upset. What we don't know is how often did Mr. Bearchild seem upset after pat-downs. Maybe this was something that he did every single time, but more likely it's something that was unique in this particular situation. In addition, we don't know how long she was waiting outside.
Okay, so, but he's representing himself. And that was in the context of a continuance. You know, what did he want a continuance for? And how did the court respond to that? And how did the court, the court took him at face value that he had presented some subpoenas and then said, and your client at first said, I have to go to trial right away. And then when he finds out that no one's there, he goes, oh my gosh, this is terrible. I'm done. I'm cooked, as it were. And so then the trial judge, albeit not perhaps ideal, says, okay, what can we do to get people here and still have your trial? And he says Ball is his main witness. So Ball, he makes arrangements and perhaps tells the Department of Corrections, hey, if you want to go ahead right now, then you get this person in and all of that. And your client knew that he had to pay for Ms. Simmons to be there, and he hadn't done that. And I don't find anything, the court can't pay for that. There's nothing, you're not asking the court to pay for that. So I'm just, I'm trying to put myself in the trial judge's position so that now that you can recharacterize that it's a completely different situation and she was key and that further investigation should have been done, which the court couldn't. There were two statements that had already been taken from her. The court couldn't have said, okay, well, now right now I want to order the Department of Corrections to go out and take more statements on Mr. Bearchild's behalf. Could the court have done that?
No, Your Honor, but I think what...
Well, this is an abuse of discretion standard, right?
We think this is an abuse of discretion standard,
Are we going to talk about the instructions?
We are going to talk
about the instructions. I have a lot of concern about Instruction 12. Do you have any further answer you wanted to give to Judge Callahan's question?
I did, yeah, if that's okay, Your Honor. So I would say that the district court actually knew prior to the day of trial that Mr. Bearchild had not submitted a subpoena. If you look at, well, obviously first on the day of the trial, he admits that he knew that Mr. Bearchild hadn't submitted a subpoena and was concerned about how Mr. Bearchild would have witnesses and more specifically how he would get his...
And the court went out of his way to get some of the witnesses lined up for him to testify from prison.
He
did.
And
this is an abuse of discretion standard.
Well, we think that just as in cases like Rand v. Roland and Woods v. Carey, where the court found that it was important to have the district court tell the litigant, the pro se inmate at the time when the issue arose, that here the district court could have reached out with regard to the subpoena when they
could have. It's an abuse of discretion standard and you have less than 10 minutes. Can we talk about the instruction, please?
Sure.
Great. Let's talk about Instruction 12, please. I have a lot of concern about this instruction. You seem to think it's a causation issue. I'm concerned that this instruction is contrary to our case law, and Wood and Choink in particular, that establishes pretty much, establishes that when there's a sexual assault in prison, there's an Eighth Amendment violation.
Yes, Your Honor, and we think so too. Importantly here, the jury was never asked the simple question of whether or not there was a sexual assault. Instead, they were led to believe with elements
that... Well, they were, right? The 13, isn't Instruction 13 the definition of sexual assault that you stipulated to that comes out of the prison Rape Elimination Act?
So Instruction 13 does describe the regulation from the PREA.
Was that a yes? Is that right? Am I?
Yes, that's
okay.
A yes.
All right.
But the jury did not have any... the jury instructions didn't close the loop as to how the jury would apply whatever it learned from Instruction 13 to Instruction 12.
Was there a special verdict form, counsel, or any instruction that said if you find a sexual assault, that is, if you find that Instruction 13 is satisfied, you don't need to make these findings in Instruction 12?
No, Your Honor. The verdict just said if you find for the defendant, check this. If you find for the plaintiff, check that. So here we really don't know how the jury interpreted Instruction 12, but we do know that the elements here are foreclosed by this court's precedent. And I think in this case, you can tell that there's error because, and significant error, because this is a person who had several similar complaints about him in 2013 to the point that the jail sent him back for remedial training. We also, the jury had in front of it several PREA reports of similar conduct. The guards joked about the search, they indicated this during the PREA investigation.
So did the jury hear all of that?
The jury had this in the documents that were submitted to it.
So the jury got to consider that.
Right, and so what we would argue is that if the jury had been able to consider that with the correct instructions, they would have come out in favor of Mr. Bearchild, or at least there's a significant chance that they would have come out in favor
of Mr. Bearchild. What should the instructions have said?
As we submitted in our 28J letter, the ideal instructions would ask if there was a sexual assault while allowing for the fact that there has to be some...
Can I just break that down?
Oh, sure.
So you had Instruction 13, and I think you stipulated to the definition of sexual assault from the Prison Rape Elimination Act, right? We established that... Is that a yes? These aren't trick questions. I'm trying to follow you.
I just want to be clear on that, Your Honor.
Okay.
We would not assume that Instruction 13 is the correct test under the Eighth Amendment since it's just a regulation.
Okay.
But we do think that in this case it would have been the better instruction.
Okay. So if, fair enough. So if there's an instruction, let's say for a minute, there was an instruction that you're not really challenging, I don't think, about the definition of sexual assault.
Yes.
And then had the jury found sexual assault, what should Instruction 12 have said?
I think that Instruction 12 should have simply said, if you found sexual assault, it's an Eighth Amendment violation. It didn't need to add all of these extra elements to do so. Because under our case law, excessive and necessary force, malicious and sadistically, are all part of the assumptions or part of the definition of a sexual assault.
So tell me how, when I fundamentally look at how the parties presented what had happened, you have the Department of Corrections saying that it was a search, that he fought, you know, how, and they, you have, I think, was it two of them? Or how many?
Oh, two inmates who were searched?
Well, no, but they have how many? We don't have Ms. Simmons, but were there five people that were actually called as witnesses that had witnessed this particular thing?
So I don't think all of the witnesses were called. Also, Mr. Pasha's senior officer was called, Lieutenant Zuber, to demonstrate.
Okay. Yes, so they say that there's a penological reason for why they did this, and that it was this, and they say what happened. And your client and his and Mr. Ball described the event differently and how he felt about this. So I find it, if they had believed your client that the officers did this either for harassment, embarrassment, or fondling, or any of the allegations that your client said, why couldn't, under these instructions, couldn't they have found for your client? Because it seems to me that it really pretty much came down to, if you believe the officers that they were doing it as part of what their search procedures are and all of that, and I think that Mr. Pasha said that he felt something in the waistband and that he felt compelled that he had to look forward, and the defendant said that it was his penis, so I asked him to pull it out, he pulled it out, and then that, so, and then we have the defendant's side of what, how he felt about it. To me, if they believe the officer that he's doing it for that reason, and he had another person there, then I think your client loses. If they believed your client, then I think under these instructions, your client would have won. I don't believe that's what I'm saying. I don't think a jury would condone this activity if it were for harassment, embarrassment, or sexual satisfaction. Would they do that?
Well, first of all, we
presume. If the instructions weren't perfect, how do you show that it prevented your client from winning?
We presume that a jury follows the instructions in the case, and here the instructions would have required them to find these other things. And as in Wood v. Beauclair, the court is concerned about, and in the Tenth Circuit case, Guerin v. Department of Corrections, the court is concerned about how a jury would come out on these things. So we don't.
Wait, right there. I think Judge Callahan's getting right to it. We do presume the jury follows the instructions. They had both instruction 12 and 13, and we read the instructions as a set. We read them as a whole. Is there anything wrong with instruction 13, which is the definition of sexual assault? Sexual abuse, actually. Forgive me.
Sorry. Not other than what we discussed before.
Yes. Well, 12 is the one that I have a lot of problem with because it seems to, well, it does expressly tell the jury that they should consider the extent of the injury suffered and the need to use force. Those elements, those considerations are contrary, in my view, quite contrary to our decisions in Wood and Schwenk. The jury also had instruction 13.
Yes, Your Honor. But
what do we do with that, counsel?
So if we look at instruction 11 at R15, okay. Instruction 11 informs the jury that they need to find that Mr. Bearchild proved the elements in instruction 12 in order for Mr. Bearchild to win. Instruction 13 just gives you a definition, but it doesn't inform the jury about how to apply the definition. And if the jury is following the jury instructions, there would really be no room to apply that definition. And as we said from before, the verdict form just says defendant or plaintiff. It doesn't say, do you also think there was a sexual assault, and some other instructions got you hung up on that.
So 11 says, in order to prevail on the 1983 claim against the defendants, Mr. Bearchild must prove each of the following. And then it says, if you find that he's proved each of these elements, and if you find that he's proved all the elements required under 12, you should find a verdict for the plaintiff, but doesn't direct them to instruction 13. That's your argument?
Yes, in terms of, it doesn't close the loop with instruction 13.
Okay, thank you.
Or to state it differently, I think what you really want is to say, if you find under instruction 13 sexual abuse,
you're done.
You're done. You win.
Right. That would be the idea.
And that instruction 12 takes them down a garden path where they're invited to ask whether or not there was a malicious and sadistic act, even though for our law, sexual assault is by definition such.
Yes, Your Honor.
They're invited to bring their own definitions to that, even though we've independently defined it. Yep.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. Your Honors, I'm Kirsten Madsen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Montana, and I represent Sergeant Pasha. We ask that you affirm the jury's verdict in this case. The jury was correctly instructed, and there was no abuse of discretion.
Well, 12 is kind of patterned from a model jury instruction for excessive force. And so why shouldn't the jury instructions be different when you're talking about a sexual assault, not excessive force alleged? It seems that some portions of the model instruction for excessive force were irrelevant here because the incident was not a situation where the officer was using physical force to control a potentially dangerous situation. Why couldn't the jury have been confused with some of those factors?
Well, I think that it's important to distinguish between the three elements that he must prove in order to prevail, which is what the instruction directs the jury to do, and the elements that they can consider. I also think that element number two, which is the malicious and sadistic as opposed to a good faith effort to maintain order and restore discipline, is important because it covers both theories that were presented in this case. This court has said that if there was a sexual assault, that they can presume malicious and sadistic intent. Sergeant Pasha's theory in this case, however, was that
now you're referring to instruction 12. The jury's instructed in order to determine whether the defendant acted maliciously and sadistically, the jury was to consider the need to use force, the relationship, all of these. You think all of this is important? Relevant?
I certainly argue that it was relevant, but I do think that for the purposes of this discussion, what I was trying to draw your attention to is the difference between an element and a factor that they could consider as opposed to have to prove.
Well, I know, and I think you're using elements two different ways. So could you back up and explain this again, your argument?
Sure. With regard to element number two, the malicious and sadistic and good faith.
Instruction 12?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The plaintiff's theory was that he was sexually assaulted, as I was saying, and this court has said that if sexual assault is established, that there we can presume malicious and sadistic intent. Sergeant Pasha's theory in this case, which was presented and reviewed multiple times, that was the crux of most of the cross-examination in this case, was that he was doing his job and that his job required him to put his hands in the inmate's groin. In fact, he had to deliberately pass
Absolutely.
His...
Absolutely, and so it's a question of, unlike other cases, I mean, in prison, guards are allowed and required to touch people in places that would not be tolerated anyways, incredibly intrusive. We understand that, absolutely. Yes. But I don't know where the jury was instructed anywhere in this case. It's tricky because some touching was clearly permitted by the guard and probably required by the guard. And then the question is scope and intent, right?
Correct.
How long did it go on and what was it for? Was there fondling? Correct. Was there groping and so forth? Where is the jury told that?
Well, there wasn't a specific instruction on the theory.
Force is required in this case. That's Judge Callahan's point.
Mm-hmm.
In order to exceed the scope of a permissible touch, right?
Correct.
Order to exceed the scope of the legitimate penological purpose, no force is required.
Well, that is correct. I would point this court's attention to the fact that while sexual assault, if it is established, does result in an Eighth Amendment violation, but not all Eighth Amendment violations are sexual assault. And, you know, with a pro se party on the other side, it's a little bit of a tricky situation, right? You want to do enough to protect your own client from prejudice without arguing the other side's case. I think in this instance...
I appreciate that, and I also want to say, we're all mindful, that there's no model instruction here. He's also a very conscientious judge. Nevertheless, here we are, and it is our job to help walk through this and figure out maybe there should be a model instruction. And this feels like a square peg to me, a round hole. These feel like really different, especially in light of Wood and Schwenk.
Yeah, and I think that the existing case law on this is, frankly, it's not. It doesn't answer the question in this case.
I'm not sure it doesn't. Why not? Our case law says if there's a sexual assault in prison, that's an Eighth Amendment violation, and you don't have to find these elements here. They're satisfied.
Well, I think that you can consider, however, the factors, not the elements, the factors at issue with regard to Sergeant Pasha's conduct. And
to determine whether there's a sexual assault.
Because
some
it's not
required.
A sexual assault if he's doing it for
a legitimate
his job.
Purpose.
Correct.
Where's the instruction that tells the jury how to parse that?
Well, I don't think there is one. And the point I think I was trying to make, and perhaps I missed the mark, it seems, is that Mr. Bearchild's case was a bit discombobulated. You know, he did his best, but there was a number of theories as to what constituted the Eighth Amendment violation. There was his pretrial version and the trial testimony of Mr. Ball. There was Mr. Bearchild's version. And then there was also the subject of his entire redirect and most of his cross-examination, which was whether there was a policy violation, not with regard to 5 minutes of stroking and fondling during a path search, but with regard to the instruction to pull out his waistband. And that, I think, was an issue that was sort of peppering all over the trial. And so I can't argue Mr. Bearchild's case for him, but mm-hmm. it is nevertheless true that if he failed to establish a sexual assault, there was still this other issue looming around the case with regard to the policy on having the inmate conduct what Mr. Bearchild suggested that he had to expose himself, but other people characterized it as a partial unclothed body inspection.
Here's my problem as best I can state it. It reiterates some of the things that have already been expressed by my colleagues. The instruction given, that is to say 12, clearly was not tailored for what we have here in front of us. If I'm the jury, I have to find all three of these things in order to find liability. I have to find excessive and unnecessary force. I have to find malicious and sadistic and harm. Now, let me go through those one by one. Excessive and unnecessary force, this is a fondling case. I mean, I'm not even sure we can talk about force meaningfully at all, let alone excessive force. But the jury is told they have to find excessive and unnecessary force when the testimony by the plaintiff really didn't involve force at all. It involved some sort of coercion, like you have to do this, but as we would ordinarily use the term force, I don't think there was force. Second, acted maliciously and sadistically for the purpose of causing harm. Well, we say that sexual assault necessarily includes that, but the jury doesn't know that. And finally, caused harm. Well, harm, what do we mean harm? Was he physically harmed? No. Maybe the jury thinks that physical harm is necessary. I mean, all three of these are potentially very misleading. How do you respond to that? And the jury's told they have to find all three.
Mm-hmm. So can I pile on before you answer? I think it's even a little worse because on harm, the last point Judge Fletcher mentioned, the jury is instructed when considering whether that element, they had to consider the extent of any injury suffered.
I guess, did you ever argue that the fact that he had no injuries, that he wasn't entitled to win?
Is this excessive and unnecessary questioning?
Certain of abuse. Well, certainly not, Your Honors. I will attempt to answer them all, and we'll see how well I do. To your question, I did argue that he did not establish that he was injured, and that that was a factor that they could consider. Mm-hmm. To the first point, with regard to the first three elements, I would just point out, with regard to element one, the excessive and unnecessary force, they did not appeal that specific portion of this instruction. Nevertheless, to your question, I think that the the issue is whether the force, which of course is an imperfect correlation for this specific case, exceeded the scope. And those, I think, are again covered with regard to the factors, for instance, the relationship between the need to use it and the amount that was used.
Well, but wouldn't it be, okay, I could see that force is, if you touch someone and they don't want to be touched and you don't have a good reason to touch them, I could see where that could be force. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're forcing yourself on, you know, you're touching someone in a way. But I'm the injury part of it, it would seem to me if you had a guard that was going around and asking people to pull their pants down or check in their pants and touching them, and it didn't appear that under circumstances that they needed to be searched, that person arguably would not be physically injured. They wouldn't have to scratch them, cut them, do any of those things. But I'm pretty sure that's a 1983 violation. I mean, you don't think it is? They have to injure their testicles or something while they're doing this, or what?
No, I don't think it's quite that definitive.
It kind of bothers me that you argued that they had to injure them.
If I could just get to your first point, and then I'll come back to this. To the first question with regard to whether the you know, just any application of force. I think the context of this case is that it's in a prison where there's a multitude of unwanted contacts, right? The inmates are not, I think if you ask most of them, they would say they don't want to be touched. Nevertheless, we do require that of correctional officers, and so I think the context matters. Now, with regard to the specific injury discussion in this case, the fact of the matter is injury and harm are imperfectly correlated, as same with injury and force. Nevertheless, the total absence of an injury is, it's one thing that a jury can consider, and that's what it says here. It's one thing among at least five different things that they could consider. And I thought it was important. That's part of the reason that I argued it to the jury, and it's the reason that it was discussed with a multitude of people. But Mr. Bearchild had...
Well, because that would go beyond what you had to do to search for penological reasons?
Well...
I mean, I could see that argument, but I didn't hear you to say that's exactly what...
Well, I was concerned with the idea that there might be left on the table because of all the discussion of the pulling out of the waistband when up until that point we've been discussing the 5 minutes issue. I was a little bit concerned that we might be getting a field of that, that now we might be talking about whether Sergeant Pasha exceeded the scope of force that he needed to do, and that this pulling out of the waistband for this partial unclothed body inspection was somehow improper. And for that reason, I think that now we're getting into whether the injury was, I think, becomes even more relevant.
Was the jury in any way told that harm for purposes of liability here goes beyond physical harm and include things like humiliation? Because if the story that Mr. Bearchild tells is true, what's happening here is the guard is trying to humiliate him and do so sexually. The guard is not trying to cause him physical harm. He's trying to cause him psychological harm. Was the jury ever aware that that was a permissible or included part of the definition of harm?
Not expressly, although Mr. Bearchild did argue directly to the jury that it offended his dignity, and I suspect he probably was quoting directly from prior orders in the case that had outlined that offenses to human dignity were a harm.
Uh-huh. But the jury wasn't told that that was cognizable as harm within the meaning of the liability of question.
There was no other additional instruction on harm.
This comes right in. And since you're, I think, very stalwart in answering, I don't even know how you're keeping track of our questions.
I'm not sure I've answered them all.
No, you're doing great. So since you're doing so well, I'm going to just exceed the scope of the briefing entirely here.
Good.
Because I am really interested in this. You stipulated, I think, the two of you, to instruction 13. And that's, for purposes of this trial, sexual abuse was defined in accordance with the Prison Rape Elimination Act, mm-hmm. which doesn't include humiliate. You would have to show that a staff member has the intent to abuse, arouse, or gratify sexual desire.
Correct.
And it also includes touching in very specific, I'm going to just say intimate body parts for purposes of speeding my question along. I'm not so sure in this day and age, since we're talking about the Eighth Amendment,
mm-hmm.
If this is the right definition at all. I just want to give you a chance to... albeit on your feet, to respond. Why, if it's easy to imagine a prison guard in a hypothetical case caressing a prisoner's face or hair in a way that I would think would be sexual assault by today's standards, but that's not covered by this definition. So where did this one come from? Why was this used here?
The specific source for it is the... CFR definition for the under PREA. The reason that I asked for it and that it was stipulated to is because we had introduced a number of investigations regarding Sergeant Pasha under PREA, and I thought that the definition of what constituted sexual abuse was important for the jury to be able to put those in context.
Okay, so could I ask the question about what would the state's position be, if you can tell me, about a hypothetical where a prison guard strokes a female prisoner's, let's just make it as sexist as possible, since it's a hypothetical, a male guard stroking, caressing a female prisoner's face or hair. Is that sexual assault?
I think she can prove,
it'd be hard for her to prove it, but if she could prove it was for gratifying sexual desire, would that count?
I don't think that, I'm not aware of a definition of sexual abuse that would include that. I think that it has to be an intimate body part. Under the definitions that I'm aware of, for instance, under Montana state law or under federal criminal law, I think all are specific to,
right. You know, so if we adopt a definition, should that be included?
Should which piece of that be included? The
well, I'm just wondering, there's two parts of this. One is that the current definition, the one you've used, it only includes very intimate body parts, not a face, not stroking someone's hair or caressing someone's hair. The other part that it leaves out is it is limited to abusing, arousing, or gratifying sexually. It doesn't include humiliation. And in this case, the allegation was that this was done to humiliate. should the definition be expanded to include those things as Eighth Amendment violations?
I don't think so. I think that the Supreme Court has said pretty clearly in a multitude of Eighth Amendment cases that the question is the intent to harm, and that the harm can include humiliation when it involves the intimate parts of a person's body. But there are, unfortunately, a number of aspects of being incarcerated that are humiliating. They're not, I don't think anybody enjoys it.
But wouldn't the prisoner, and then I'll let you go, but I promise, you're probably going to want to get on a plane back to Montana quickly, but a prisoner would have to show, this hypothetical, that her hair was, or her face was, caressed or groped in order to show, for the purpose of sexual gratification. Does that change your answer? I can't see any circumstance where a legitimate penological objective is served if it's for the purpose of sexual desire.
Yeah, no, I think if they can establish that it's for the purpose of sexual gratification, we've entered a different zone.
Okay.
Part of my hang-up is that I'm thinking of part of a clothed body search can include an inspection of someone's hair.
But not for purposes of gratifying sexual desire.
Correct.
Okay.
So how did the all of the other investigation of Pasha come in? Did you just turn those over to him and not object to them coming in, or did he advocate for it? How did that come?
It was sort of awkwardly, Your Honor. I did oppose it. I filed a point brief on it. I argued it orally to the court. We had spent a number of briefing rounds discussing whether there was going to be a protective order to protect the inmates who are identified in these other reports. The court identified to me which specific investigations it was considering putting in. I believe it was the evening of the first day of trial, on the morning of the second day of trial. After Mr. Bearchild had rested his case, the court ruled that it was going to permit them to come in over my objection after I had started my case. And so it was...
So the court sounds like it. Did it kind of... Did Mr. Bearchild ask for those, or did the court on its own just say, well, I think this should come in?
He had been asking for them for quite some time. I mean, it was a serious bone of contention whether he was going to be able to know who these inmates were, whether he was going to be able to call them as witnesses. He said, I'm summarizing, his argument wasn't quite that complete, but that, to me, was the thrust of what he was getting at. And he had said a couple of times that he'd kept referring to, and I think during the pretrial conference, the court had said, well, I have determined that I might admit some of these and not others. And throughout Mr. Bearchild's testimony, he'd made reference to the stack of papers at my table and things of that nature.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you please put 2 minutes on the clock?
Thanks. And to just address 2 points, unless the court has any questions. The first is, as you were discussing force, opposing counsel conceded that no force is required for a sexual assault. And here... As was already noted, the jury was informed that they should consider whether or not there was a physical injury to Mr. Bearchild. What I wanted to emphasize is the jury really needed to disagree or find that Mr. Bearchild hadn't proved at least one of these elements for Mr. Bearchild to lose in this case. So whether it was malicious and sadistic, or whether it was harm, or whether it was the force requirement, really the jury only had to find that Mr. Bearchild didn't meet the requirements for one of those elements. With regard to the other point you made about whether this is just humiliation or whether it was more, I, of course, can't find it in the record, but Mr. Bearchild did allege that he believed that the source of his sexual assault was because he had mentioned before that he had no problem with his gay roommate. And I think he also...
He had no problem with his what?
His gay roommate. It was something that he thought was the source of the sexual assault. And I would also say that he was referring to the fact that this bothered him because of his prior sexual abuse as a child. And so I don't think that, although it's not entirely clear in the pleadings, but I don't think that Mr. Bearchild was just saying that this was done for humiliation. I think he also thought that there was a sexual gratification component. The court has no more questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case, Bearchild versus Cobbin, submitted. But before we break, I'd like to say thank you very much. This is you've done this pro bono. We very much appreciate this. This is very helpful to the court. You've done a lovely job. You have too, but you're being paid.
I would also like to thank her. The input of an attorney in this case has really helped focus the issues.
Okay. So thank both sides. You've done a very nice job on both sides. The case is submitted. We'll now take a 10-minute break.